Hello, everyone. Welcome to this very special edition of Our Thoughts Tonight. If it's your first time here, consider subscribing or following us on Twitter. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy.
Our Thoughts Tonight.
Welcome, everybody.
Bailey is here.
Hi there.
Zach is here.
Yep.
Ashik is here.
Hello.
And I'm your host, in human form. Today, our special guest is cognitive scientist, political activist, the one and only Noam Chomsky. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Yeah. Okay, should I introduce my two dogs that are right down below?
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
That would be great.
You can hear them, I think.
Yeah, we can.
It's a pleasure to meet you, by the way, I have to say. I wanted to mention before we ask you a few questions, over the last few months in preparation for our interview, I've been listening to your audiobooks and interviews on my way to work and school and on my drive home. So it's felt as if you've been teaching me about the world from my passenger seat. So it's good to finally meet you. So my first question for you today is one that I believe the whole world is wondering at the moment, and that has to do with the escalating tensions between Russia, United States, and NATO. Considering the nuclear implications, what are your thoughts on this situation?
Well, first of all, let's remember that this has been happening about every year, roughly at this time, since 2014, when the Maidan uprising led to a coup that overthrew the pro-Russian government and put in a U.S.-oriented government with U.S. backing, of course. Ever since then, every spring, there have been similar warnings. Russian mobilization, tens or hundreds of thousands of troops ready to attack. This time the voices are more shrill, but it's basically the same story. Maybe something's real, maybe not. Another possibility is that Putin, as many analysts point out, has been trying for years to get the United States to pay some attention to Russian security concerns, which go back 30 years. We don't talk about it much here, but it's very much discussed elsewhere. As the Soviet Union was collapsing around 1990, there were extensive negotiations between the United States, that's President Bush and James Baker, and Russia, that was Mikhail Gorbachev, and also the Germans, who were very much involved, Genscher, Kohl. Germans were involved because the crucial issue was unification of Germany. Well, Gorbachev actually agreed to unification of Germany within NATO, hostile military alliance, which is quite a concession if you look back at the history of the 20th century. Germany alone had virtually destroyed Russia twice during the century. So agreeing to have Germany rearm, joining NATO is not a small concession, but there was a quid pro quo. Bush and Baker promised that NATO would not advance one inch to the east. East meant East Berlin, East Germany. Nobody was thinking about anything beyond, at least publicly. Well, that was the agreement in 1990. Bush himself pretty much lived up to it. Clinton came in on the 50th anniversary of NATO, 1999. Clinton celebrated it by inviting states on the borders of Russia into NATO, Poland, Ukraine, Czech Republic. Big step. Then Bush II came along and all the bars were down. Just invited everybody, even offered Ukraine an invitation to join NATO. That's a non-starter. Ukraine is geostrategic heartland of the Russian system. It's no Russian leader would ever accept that Gorbachev firmly opposed it. France and Germany vetoed it, but under U.S. pressure, it stays on the agenda. but still there. That's the background. Then came the 2014 coup and various events that followed. And since then, these... Hold on a second.
It's all good.
Dog out of here.
Yeah, we're having the same problem.
Okay, now only one left, and this one's usually quiet.
That's good.
The other is a Maltese who gets very agitated.
Yeah.
Well, where we are now, if you take a look at the current situation, the United States is full of militant talk. Europe is trying to move towards some form of negotiations, diplomacy. Ukraine has pretty much asked the United States to tone down the rhetoric, but still warning that there could be major problems. So that's where we stand. If Russia does invade, which I frankly doubt, it would be devastating for them. They'd have a huge guerrilla war on their hands. The United relations with Europe would break, which are very important both to Russia and to Europe. Remember that for 50 years, there's been a battle about who's going to provide petroleum to Europe. The United States wants to control it. They want to break. Russia's wants to extend it. For Europe, the Russian supplies are much cheaper, much more accessible. And the U.S. has been trying to block it. Actually, this goes back even earlier, before the Russians were in the game. It's oil politics is a huge affair and a factor in international affairs. So you go back to 1945, when the world order was being reconstituted by the United States, of course, all over the world. One of the essential parts of U.S. policy was to maintain control of Middle East oil. And the reason was the U.S. didn't need the oil. In fact, it was the biggest oil producer. But the point was to make sure that you could control Europe and Japan. George Kennan, major planner, put it straight. He said, if we control the oil, we have veto power over our allies. Now, for Europe, we go look at the Marshall Plan. A large part of the Marshall Plan was money that went between various New York banks to ensure that Europe would shift to an oil-based economy, which they don't have any oil, and switch away from a coal-based economy. They had plenty of coal. That's before the Russians were in the game. When the Russians became a major exporter again later on, that became a conflict between the United States and Russia as to who's going to supply energy to Europe. It's still on the front pages. That's what the Nord Stream pipeline is about. And Ukraine was right in the center of this. Pipelines go through Ukraine. So that's one background issue, and it's part of a much broader issue. Is Europe going to become an independent force in world affairs? That's been a major concern of the United States since the 1950s. Same is happening in Asia. Will Japan become a center of, now it's China, but for many years it was Japan, be the center of an Asian system? In fact, one of the main reasons for the Vietnam War was to prevent that. Could go into it. It's very clear in the internal planning record that they were concerned back in the early 50s, that if Vietnam became pursued successful independent development, it would have a what was called a domino effect in the region. Others would be tempted to pursue the same course. Thailand, Burma in those days, Malaysia, Indonesia, and that would lead Japan to accommodate to Asia as its technological and economic center, using Asia as a kind of a hinterland. Well, remember that the Second World War was fought to prevent that. That was Japan's new order in Asia. And the Second World War ended those aspirations. Early 1950s, the United States was not prepared to lose the Second World War. And the concern about Vietnam was just that. They didn't care about Vietnamese resources. It didn't amount to much. But it was the possible effect worldwide, in all through Asia, that was concerned. Same with Europe. I mean, Americans don't discuss this, but it's all in the record. So when the United States was working to overthrow the Allende government, the parliamentary regime in Chile, one of the main concerns, explained by Henry Kissinger, who was the architect of the policies, was that if Allende's Chile succeeded, parliamentary means to move towards social democracy, that could have major effects in Europe, Southern Europe, Italy and Spain, where similar processes were taking place, might move Europe to move towards social democracy and out of the, not only out of US control, but to an economic model that separates from the much harsher version of capitalism that the United States pursues. So therefore you had to overthrow Allende. I mean, these are right in the background of world affairs constantly. You don't talk about it here. You have to pretend that the United States is a benevolent actor trying to improve everybody's life in the world. But if you get out of that propaganda framework, all of this stuff is right in front of your eyes, right there in the internal record. Well, there were efforts through the years for Europe to move in an independent direction. One of the most famous is de Gaulle. He called de Gaulle, who was a major statesman, taken seriously, concerned. He called for what he called Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals, meaning a unified Europe, including Russia and Western Europe. That was anathema to the United States, and it managed to shoot it down. Willy Brandt, the German chancellor, tried what he called Ostpolitik, integrating Germany more closely with Russia. That was shot down. You see it right on the front pages today. When Macron, French president, goes to negotiate with the Russians and the Ukrainians, there's furor in the United States. How can he do that? You know, breaking ranks and so on. What that means is it's another move towards integrating Europe with Russia. And behind all of this is Gorbachev's vision back in the 1990, when this whole system was being established. There were two approaches. One was the US approach. NATO dominates. And they did agree not to move NATO to the east, which was then overturned by Clinton. But the idea was that Europe itself would stay completely within what's called the Atlanticist framework. Atlanticist means the US runs it. Okay, that's Gorbachev proposed something different. He proposed what he called a common European home, meaning pretty much what de Gaulle had called for, Europe linked to Russia. And he even had a more expansive vision. Europe, he said, a Eurasian security system from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from Lisbon to Vladivostok, with no military blocks. That was shot down very quickly. The United States couldn't even hear those words. But, and of course, the media can't record it. But these are all things that are in the background, bits and pieces of it in the newspapers, like when Germany wants to establish, Merkel wanted the Nord Stream pipeline. Well, that's part of it. That's a way for Germany to move somewhat out of U.S. control, have much cheaper resources and link up with Russia, and maybe move towards something like a common European home, which means the U.S. isn't running the affairs. Actually, the same thing's happening in Asia right now. So there are conflicts with China, some serious ones. A lot of it's just rhetoric. But in the South China Sea, the seas off the coast of China, there are conflicts. China's violating international law by establishing, building up small islands, which it can use for bases and so on. The regional powers don't like this, but it's a regional problem. It could have a regional solution. U.S. absolutely doesn't want that. A regional solution means the U.S. doesn't run it, just like in Ukraine. No regional solutions. None of this Macron business or Gorbachev or De Gaulle. We run it, and that's world order. So the United States sends a naval armada into the South China Sea, provides Australia with a fleet of nuclear submarines to enhance the already overwhelming U.S. dominant military dominance off China's coast. The threat of China, so-called, is on China's coast. China has nothing comparable. All they have is a hinterland, which is trouble. So we have to have overwhelming military domination right at China's border, where there could be regional solutions, but that would be anathema, just as it is in Europe. I think these are background issues that should be thought about. You don't read about them. There's almost nothing said about them.
I do have a question that's semi-related here. Given this international dynamic, do you think humanity will survive long enough to see a dominant economic model other than Kissinger-inspired neoliberal capitalism?
Is there another dominant economic model? Actually, there's a conflict right now between two economic models, the U.S.-dominated one, the China-dominated one. Europe itself is hanging on weakly to a kind of social democratic model. It's important to recognize how remote the United States is from the rest of the world on social economic issues. It's astonishing when you look at it. So take something as simple as maternal leave, you know, the right of a woman to have a couple of weeks off after having a baby. Everywhere. Not the United States. The United States and a couple of Pacific islands are the only countries that don't allow it. I mean, Europe even has paternal leave. Take, say, Brazil, not a rich country, not a particularly progressive one, especially now. But a mother has, I think, 4 months guaranteed maternal leave and with pay, with another optional 2 months also at pay. In the United States, you can't even dream of it. Americans work about a month or sometimes 2 months more than people in Europe. In Europe, there's paid vacation, at least a month, maybe more. Unheard of in the United States. I mean, the worst case, of course, is the health system. Compare with Canada, say, about twice the expenses and in the United States, and life expectancy is about 4 years longer in Canada. Same with Europe. I mean, you take a look at Bernie Sanders' programs, which are considered radical in the United States. In most of the world, they just laugh.
Yeah.
There's the things they already have. And the United States is considered so radical, you can't discuss it. Well, to impose the U.S. model is not easy. In fact, if you go back in history, it's quite interesting. One of those things, again, that doesn't get discussed here. But go back to Vietnam in the early 60s, when Kennedy was beginning to escalate the war, sharp escalation under Kennedy. And you go back, and we know a ton about this. The Pentagon Papers, reports of province advisors, huge amount of documentation. It's all the same. U.S. intelligence and U.S. province advisors were despairing because the Viet Cong was fighting a political war where we're weak. We could only respond with a military war. where we're strong. So the Viet Cong organized people in villages with programs of social reform and so on. And the only thing we can do is come in with bombs and napalm and crop destruction. And it just doesn't work. And they're kind of desperate, couldn't deal with it. Can't fight a political war with a military war. And it's right on the front pages now. Just a couple of days ago, there was an interesting article in the New York Times on the Middle East. You should look at the headline. I wish I had the exact words, but it was something like this. China leans into the Middle East while the U.S. withdraws. What's actually happening? And then it says China's leaning in with loans, development projects, investments, while the U.S. is withdrawing. But what is the U.S. withdrawing? Bombs, missiles, special forces raids on villages at midnight. We're withdrawing that. China's leaning in with loans, development projects, and investments. What can we do? Can't figure out a way to stop it. Just like in South Vietnam, you know. You can't, it's very hard to fight a political war with bombs and missiles. It just doesn't reach people somehow. It's actually Secretary of State Dulles back in the 50s captured it very well in his private discussion with Eisenhower, president, said we have a real problem with the communists. They can appeal to the poor people, which is just about everybody in the third world. They appeal to the poor who have always wanted to plunder the rich. And he didn't add the next part, which is we can't appeal to them with policies that want the rich to plunder the poor. Just somehow doesn't appeal to these childish people there. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the problem. So the concern over, in fact, it's amazing the extent to which it goes. There was just a couple of days ago, finally something passed in the House of Representatives, a bill to build up U.S. technology investment in research and advanced industries and so on. What was it called? It was called the China Competitive Bill. We can't try to build up technology because it would be good for people like you. Who cares about that? We can only do it if it enables us to compete with China, which means to beat China down by blocking their economic development and somehow doing it ourselves. And this is just taken for granted. You look at the liberal press, you know, the left liberal press, they were very impressed with this. Biden made a real achievement. Now we can better compete with China. How about we could do something useful for Americans? It's not even a consideration. You know, you can't think about it.
I think Zach had a question kind of related to COVID-19.
How do you think COVID-19 will be presented in the history books? Do you think it will be remembered as solely a pandemic, or do you think there's a chance it could go down as a global cultural shift?
Well, they did a extensive research study together with many research scientists in which they concluded that we could save 1 million lives in the South, global South, 1 million lives at a reasonable cost just by providing them with the facilities to produce vaccines. Okay. And then it goes on, discusses it, gets to the last paragraph of the article, says Pfizer and Moderna, which hold the patents to the processes, even though taxpayer funding was used to develop them, they hold the patents. They say they can't do it. And then it adds that they made, I think it says, $100 billion of profit last year. Well, that's our model. Big corporations have to be protected to make huge profits, you know, beyond the dreams of avarice. And if we kill 1 million people, it's too bad. It's not the kind of policy that's easy to sell in the South. fortunately, not much attention is paid to it, but the article's worth reading. Tells you a lot about the capitalist, our version of the capitalist model.
We were wondering which article were you mentioning? Was this the one that in the New York Times that you mentioned?
This one that I was just quoting was in the Washington Post.
Okay, Washington Post. Okay.
Write me an email. I can send you the link.
That sounds good. Ashik, did you want to ask?
Yeah, I guess not to divert the topics not too far. I just wanted to ask this question. This is kind of a fusion question between me and a certain professor from the University of Alaska Anchorage. Just in terms of your linguistic work, how do you view that in terms of the history of similar ideas, maybe older traditional philosophies, Kant, Husserl, especially in light of like people, I don't want to use the word accused, but using universal grammar as a sort of innate idea. How do you view claims like that?
Well, there was a long tradition, goes back to Aristotle, the Indian grammar at the same time, which regarded language basically as a system of thought. Go back to Aristotle, as he said, there are abstract words which we have in our minds, which are symbols of thought, which are mental representations of the world, and they're the same for all people. They're universal. And they go on to develop not very extensive ways of formulating propositional thought, subject, predicate, and so on. That's all internal, innate, fixed, common to all humans. Then he said there are spoken words which vary from language to language. That's just accidental, uninteresting. So he just concentrated on the internal system. Same with Indian philosophy. That goes all the way to the 20th century, pretty much. Mm-hmm. 20th century changed. The structuralist, behaviorist movements shifted attention away from these concerns to behavior and communication. So W.V. Quine, leading philosopher of language, for him, language was a complex of dispositions to respond to stimuli and behavior of others imposed by operant conditioning. And Leonard Bloomfield, major American linguist, language, he said, is a matter of habit and teaching and habit. That's all. If there's anything new that comes along, it's by analogy. That's the 20th century. And language is regarded mainly as system of communication, kind of like evolving out of animal communication. It's a radical shift from 2,500 years of thinking about language as basically an internal system of thought. Language generates thought. Thought's what's generated by language. Includes Frege, Humboldt, Galileo, everybody. Well, my own opinion is the tradition was correct. And I think we have to go back to it. Mm-hmm. And modern, it's called the generative enterprise. It's basically re-asking again the same questions that were traditionally asked, but from a much more, from a new standpoint. Something important happened in the 20th century. The mathematical theory of communication was developed, of computation, mathematical theory of computation. Turing, Gödel, Emil Post, and others made it very clear how a finite device like the brain or your laptop can have the capacity to generate an infinite array of objects, in the language case, an infinite array of thoughts, which can then be used in one or another way, sometimes rarely for communication. It's a different picture. This was a block that couldn't be overcome in the tradition. They had no way to account for how a finite object could have infinite capacity. Galileo, for example, regarded language as the most astonishing development, most awesome development in ever, he said, because it enables us with a few symbols to construct infinitely many thoughts and even somehow to convey to others the innermost workings of our mind, major miracle. Galileo regarded the alphabet as the most spectacular invention ever because it was able to implement this. But how it happened was left as a major mystery in the early scientific revolution and right through the tradition. Well, now we have a way to partially grasp that problem, not totally. Mm-hmm. The question of how you produce thoughts is kind of a mystery. We don't know anything about that. But how you can construct them in your mind, yes, that we can study. And we've learned a good, great deal about the nature of the systems, which raises many crucial questions, could go into it. But that does resurrect a lot of the concerns of traditional philosophy, science, language, thinking way back to classical Greece and classical India.
Maybe as a caveat to language, but in a different sense, this is another question from a professor. In your own writing, you employ dry irony, sarcasm. It makes your writing very enjoyable to read. But as coming from a teaching perspective, from his view, what kind of guidelines would you have for readers in terms of trying to point out what is sarcastic or what's not, especially for people who are not so familiar with your work? Do you have any general guidelines for your writing in general?
Well, you can find out a lot of it's transcribed. So there's two areas. One of them is the kind of questions you were just asking, linguistics, philosophy, cognitive science, history of thought, and so on. Plenty of books about that. The other side, what we were talking about earlier, the politics side, a lot of that's in print. There's transcripts, pretty close transcripts of a course that I co-teach at the University of Arizona. The book is called Consequences of Capitalism. And it essentially is the lectures from the course, mine and my...
I just started reading that earlier this week.
Well, so you can tell.
It's excellent.
And it's going on right now, in fact.
Right.
Yeah. But we're right in the middle of another version of the course.
Oh, nice.
Oh, man. I'm excited to read the next one and that one. But my question, I'm realizing, is oddly referential to what we're talking about already, kind of. Having arrived where you are politically, likely through your research into linguistics, do you have any hints for those of us who are trying to learn how to interact with the world so as to learn from it? Could it be, as the artist Tim Minchin has said, that we could stand to adopt a little neuropsychological humility?
Well, the work on the nature of language and thought doesn't directly give any indications of how you should interact with the world, how you can teach people, and so on. But if you think about it more broadly, there is a connection. And in fact, the connection was widely discussed during the Enlightenment. People like Wilhelm von Humboldt, who I've quoted, one of the founders of classical liberalism of the modern research university, and also a very important linguist who was working within the tradition that I described, identified language and thought, but also wrote about education, social life, and connected the two. The basic connection was the idea that at the core of human nature is what was sometimes called an instinct for freedom, that you see it very clearly in language, where the core property of language is what Galileo and others noticed, our ability to create independently new thoughts never appeared before, and even to convey to others the workings of our mind, and they can understand it. That's the core human ability, what essentially distinguishes us from the rest of the animal world. It's a creative capacity. Well, that had an implication for education and society. The implication is anything that interferes with this creative capacity is illegitimate. So in teaching, what's now called teach to test, totally illegitimate. They ridiculed that in the Enlightenment as like pouring water into a vessel, and then some of the water comes out. But that's the worst possible form of education. Nothing stays in your mind. The right form of education is a little bit like what Rousseau talked about, or what Humboldt talked about, trying to stimulate, encourage the natural tendency of students, children, graduate students to inquire, to create, to pursue their own concerns and capacities in cooperation with others. That would be real education. And the same is true in social organization altogether. Anything in the structure of society that inhibits the natural exercise of the right for freedom and independence has to be questioned. Now, that doesn't mean what's called libertarianism here. That's just a ridiculous misinterpretation of it. But it does mean something like what's now called social democracy, or more serious moves towards what used to be understood as socialism, meaning workers' control over their enterprises, democratic control over communities, cooperation among them, and so on. All of those ideas are right in the Enlightenment, and they do have a connection with the a loose connection with the conception that the fundamental property of human beings, distinguishing them from animals, is this creative capacity manifested most clearly in normal use of language. So there is that kind of connection. It's not a logical connection. It's a connection of sort of spirit.
I want to thank you for joining us today. Really means a lot.
Thank you so much.
Good to be with you. Sorry, I got to take off.
Oh, to write a song that has no meaning at all, that doesn't touch a personal nerve or heed a social call, that knows no up or down, that has no right or wrong, that doesn't need a reason to waste some time with song, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I'll sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Doesn't let it all hang out, that doesn't wave any flag or have any slogan to shout, that knows no east or west, that has no left or right, that doesn't throw any stones or look for any fight, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Promise a brand new start that doesn't preach of rain and fire or heed any higher call, that doesn't need a reason to mean nothing at all, just like that old time rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll, and I sing ba-bop, shabop, and whoa, whoa, whoa. Just like that old time
rock and roll with the easy chords and a touch of soul. Give me old time rock and roll. And I sing bop, shabop, bam, whoa, whoa, whoa. Bop, shabop, bam, whoa, whoa, whoa. Bop, shabop, bam, whoa, whoa, whoa.